This lecture is produced by Stone Kingdom Ministries of Asheville, North Carolina. Follow along in your Bible as James Brueggemann shares good news from God's Word. For a sample copy of our publication and a catalog of the resources available, write to Stone Kingdom Ministries, Post Office Box 5695, Asheville, North Carolina, zip code 28813. You may also visit us on the web at www.stonekingdom.org. Your regular financial support is what makes this ministry possible, and we are grateful to you for that. And now, here is Bible teacher James Brueggemann.
This is part two of today's message, and we've entitled the whole thing, Providence and Politics. And now we come to some real political intrigues. We're in 2 Samuel 3, beginning in verse 6. And it came to pass, while there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, that Abner made himself strong for the house of Saul. Literally, is Abner was strengthening his hold on the house of Saul. Verse 7. And Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Wherefore hast thou gone in unto my father's concubine?" Here is the first incident which we wish to consider as we observe divine providence acting through politics. First, it could be argued that Ishbosheth was falsely accusing Abner, because it doesn't really tell us here that Abner actually had intimate relations with the concubine Rizpah. It simply says that Ishbosheth accused Abner of it. But we're going to assume that it did occur. We're not basing any doctrines here on this debatable fact, so if we're wrong, it's not going to wreck our faith. But the way I see it, this was not just a simple act of lust on the part of Abner. It was a move of calculated political intimidation. You see, it was customary in those times, in those centuries, that when the king died, his harem, his concubines, were inherited by his son. So these concubines became Ishbosheth's. Abner, in taking one of the harem, was therefore pushing the envelope to see how much he could get away with, to see how much he could insult Ishi without Ishi taking any action to try to stop him. But by taking the king's concubine, Abner was in effect claiming the throne. How Ishbosheth would finally respond would therefore define the limits of their respective power. Abner had evidently finally pushed the hot button. Ishbosheth was not a total fool. He realizes Abner's trying to usurp the throne here, so Ishi is in essence accusing Abner of treason. Cleverly, Abner plays the game to the hilt now, feigning like he's the one that has the right to be insulted. Verse 8, "Then was Abner very wroth for the words of Ishbosheth, and said, Am I a dog's head, which against Judah do show kindness this day unto the house of Saul thy father, to his brethren, and to his friends, and have not delivered thee into the hand of David, that you charge me this day with a fault concerning this woman?" My opinion is that this whole thing, this whole outcome, was expected by Abner. It's the result he desired so as to have an excuse to say the following. Verse 9, "So do God to Abner, and more also, except as Yahweh has sworn to David, even so I do to him, to translate the kingdom from the house of Saul and to set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah, from Dan even to Beersheba." What is Abner threatening here? Isn't he basically saying, all right, if you think I'm a traitor, then I may as well defect over to David and help him get the entire kingdom under his monarchy. It's the kingdom God promised him anyhow. That's what it appears that he's saying to me. And he knew his nephew Ishbosheth was a jellyfish, no backbone whatsoever. So now the stage is set. Verse 11, "And he," meaning Ishbosheth, "could not answer Abner a word again, because he feared him." Poor Ishbosheth. It's clear He just did not have the mental, moral, and political equipment to be an effective ruler. But of course, how perfectly providential, so that the whole nation would then be yearning for a real political leader. It's worth noting in verses 9 and 10 that Abner knew the will of the Lord was to establish David over the whole 12 tribes. And yet, up to this point, Abner had been in opposition to what he knew was God's will. That's sin, isn't it? The political intrigue now continues with Abner immediately testing the waters with David to see if there's an opening for an alliance between them. Verse 12. And Abner sent messengers to David on his behalf, saying, "Whose is this land?" In other words, isn't the whole land of Israel yours to rule over by God's decree and promise? Saying also, "Make thy league with me, and behold, my hand shall be with thee to bring about all Israel unto thee." And he said, "Well," in other words, "good, I will make a league with thee. But one thing I," that is David, "require of thee, that is, thou shalt not see my face, except thou first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when thou comest to see my face." There is a beautiful parallel here once again between the story of Joseph and the life of David. And I see this parallel in that phrase, "Thou shalt not see my face, except thou first bring Michal, Saul's daughter." Because, after all, what tribe was Michal from? Same tribe as her daddy. What tribe was Saul from?
Benjamin.
And remember when Joseph's brothers came to Egypt during the famine to buy grain, they had no idea that the prime minister sitting there in front of them was their brother Joseph. And they, under questioning by the prime minister, they revealed they still had another youngest brother at home named Benjamin, who they said was his father's pride and joy, the light of his life. The light of his life. Benjamin's the light bearer, right? And then Joseph, prime minister of Egypt, said, "You will not see my face again except Benjamin be with you." See the parallel? And then when they did come back bringing Benjamin, Joseph took Benjamin aside and revealed to him first and to him alone his identity. Joseph symbolizes the lost 10 tribes. And in the latter days, their identity will be revealed to the Benjamin company first. I think that's beautiful. But looking now at this demand from David, he probably had mixed motives in wanting to get Michal back. Politically, having Saul's daughter to wife once again would strengthen David's claim to the throne of Saul. Moreover, David may well have retained some considerable affection for her. And he knew that she had loved him at one time. But again, this would not only be a victory over Ishbosheth on the political chessboard, because David gets his queen back, but in the eyes of all the people of the northern 10 tribes, they would now see the tide turning in David's favor. Concomitantly, they would realize how impotent their king Ishbosheth is. And so apparently there's no downside for David in striking this deal with Abner. And verse 14, "And David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, 'Deliver me my wife Michal, which I espoused to me, for 100 foreskins of the Philistines.'" 15, "And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, even from Phaltiel, the son of Laish." Up till this time, David had been waiting patiently for God's providence to bring about circumstances to fulfill his promise to David. With Abner's taking of Rizpah, David detects the providential hand now moving, and so he is inspired or emboldened to make the move demanding Michal from Ishbosheth. Here again, like Abner's taking the concubine, this was David's calculated political move to see what kind of political backbone Ishi had. And clearly, Ishi was wishy-washy, wasn't he? He was a weak sister. He was a wimp on the throne. But he was there by God's design, wasn't he? Verse 16, "And her husband went with her, along weeping behind her, to Bahurim. Then said Abner unto him, Go, return. And he returned. And Abner had communication with the elders of Israel, saying, Ye sought for David in times past to be king over you. Well, in fact, it was only Abner's very strong domination over them that had prevented many of the elders from already declaring for David for the throne. So now Abner gives his blessing on them to defect to David's side. Verse 18. Now do it, for Yahweh has spoken of David, saying, By the hand of my servant David I will save my people Israel out of the hand of the Philistines and out of the hand of all their enemies. And Abner also spake in the ears of Benjamin. And Abner went also to speak in the ears of David in Hebron all that seemed good to Israel, and that seemed good to the whole house of Benjamin. Well, the character of Abner here is patently hypocritical, because in verse 18, he's pretending religious conviction, talking about, the Lord said David would be the king. He's bringing religion in there to do what? To attain his own personal political agenda. He sees that ultimately he's going to lose against David, even if he has Ish-bosheth as his puppet. So he's now taking a look at the odds here and saying, I think I better go over to this guy and see if I can get high up in his administration. And so he's now talking to the elders of the 10 tribes, saying, now's the time to make your move, guys. As always, politics is the handmaiden of providence. Meaning, God uses political conspiracies and the evil machinations of men to accomplish his divine plan. What an awesome God. It was important politically that the tribe of Benjamin be given special attention by Abner, because they had the most to lose in terms of tribal prestige. Up until now, theirs had been the tribe of the monarchy. I mean, you're talking about a lot of jobs in the administration that are going to be lost here. Unemployment's going to be high in the tribe of Benjamin. So he had to convince them that it would be a good idea for them to go along with this. Because if they were not brought fully aboard, they could then prove to be a very painful thorn in the side of David, because where's Benjamin's territory? Right on the north edge of Judah. You want to have them to be your friends. Verse 20. So Abner came to David to Hebron, and 20 men with him. This is when he's bringing Michal. And David made Abner and the men that were with him a feast. Now, just to recapitulate the sequence of events here, first, Abner took the concubine Rizpah. This provokes Ishbosheth to charge Abner with being a traitor. Uncle Abner responds by threatening Ishi that if that's what he thinks he is, then he may as well help David gather all the kingdom. And so Abner then secretly sends envoys to David with a proposal of alliance. David tells the envoys to tell Abner, well, they have a deal as long as David gets Michal back from Ishi. Then, knowing they have a deal, Abner then has his behind-the-scenes discussions with the elders of the 10 tribes and a special meeting with the leaders of Benjamin alone, all to let them know that they can now openly support David to be king over all of them. Meanwhile, David sends an ambassador to Ishi demanding Michal be sent back to him. Ishi's so wishy that he still has to lean on Uncle Abner for advice. And so he calls him in and says, what should I do? David says I should send Michal back to him. And Abner says, well, this is a tough one, but I think you better do it, Ishbosheth. But I'll tell you what, I'll personally take charge of this myself. I'll take a contingent of 20 men, and I'll take her, and I'll personally deliver her to David. I'll make sure everything goes okay. That'd be all right? And Ishi says, sure, thanks. Because Abner tells him he really doesn't have any choice. And so after Abner hands over Michal to David, he and David then retreat up to Camp David for a little private meeting. Oh, I guess I didn't really see that in the Bible. I made that up. Verse 21. And Abner said unto David, I will arise and go, and will gather all Israel unto my lord the king, that they may make a league with thee, and that thou mayest reign over all that thine heart desireth. And David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. And behold, the servants of David and Joab came from pursuing a troop, that means making a raid, and brought in a great spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he was gone in peace. When Joab and all the host that was with him were come, they told Joab, saying, Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he has sent him away, and he is gone in peace. All right, now remember, what's the connection here with Joab and Abner? Abner had killed Joab's brother Asahel, right? Verse 24, then Joab came to the king, that is to David, and said, what have you done? Behold, Abner came unto thee. Why is it that thou hast sent him away, and he's quite gone? Thou knowest Abner the son of Ner, that he came to deceive thee, and to know thy going out and thy coming in, and to know all that thou doest. David is really receiving a tongue-lashing here from his top military commander. Joab is a very strong-willed individual. He doesn't hesitate for one second to speak his mind, castigating and excoriating David for such foolish behavior as to trust Abner. What does David do? He apparently just sits there and takes it. It's an interesting contrast and parallel here between David and Ishi, and between Joab and Abner. There's an uncle-nephew relationship surrounding both thrones. Uncle Abner is the strong-willed top military commander who treats his nephew Ishbosheth as a wad of putty. Uncle David, though, is on the throne, but he's treated by his strong-willed nephew and top military commander Joab as though he's a piece of putty. Isn't that right? And as we see, David for now appears to acquiesce to the dominance of Joab over him, which is strange, to say the least, because we know that David is no ishy-wishy wimp, is he? I mean, David took on this 10-foot-tall offspring of the Nephilim named Goliath when he was only 17 years old. So why does David sit there and take this abuse from a supposed subordinate? 26. And when Joab was come out from David, he sent messengers after Abner, which brought him again from the well of Sirah. But David knew it not. And when Abner was returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the gate to speak with him quietly, and smote him there under the fifth rib, that he died for the blood of Asahel his brother. Where was Asahel smote by Abner? Under the fifth rib. It's doubtful whether Abner would have turned around and come back to Hebron unless Joab's messengers told him that it was on David's authority that they were being sent to summon him back. And once he gets back to the gates of Hebron, he sees Joab there. Now, this is not just a wall and a gate, a pair of flaps here at the door, like a gate of a city. What they mean by the gates of Hebron, they had separate cubicle-type rooms out at the gates, and this is where a lot of the business of government was done in those days. There were these rooms just inside the gates, or outside the gates, mostly in, I guess. And so he sees Abner sees Joab there, and Joab says, oh, don't worry about it. David sent me. I got to talk to you about some private business. Come on in the room here. As soon as he gets in there and Abner's let his guard down, Joab pulls out the dagger and under the fifth rib, thrusts him through. Joab's bitterness and hatred for Abner for killing his brother was now avenged. But that was certainly not his only motive, because there was jealousy involved here, because Joab sees what's happening. Abner's making an alliance with David. I might lose my job. He was threatened by Abner coming into David's inner circle. He might become the general of the armies instead of me, Joab thinks. Politics and providence. This was a political assassination, and it wasn't by a lone nut, was it? As we're told in modern years, political assassinations are always by lone nuts, right? But once again, it was the providential means by which God accomplished several of his purposes. First of all, it was retribution upon Abner for his wicked ways, for his rebellion against David and against God, when his own conscience told him the will of God was for David to be ruler over all. But Abner had rebelled. Secondly, God took Abner out of the picture, so that David would not owe his kingdom to the deceit and treachery of Abner, but to God's providence alone. You see, had Abner lived to a ripe old age, he could always say to David, "Look here, buddy, you'd still just be king of Judah if it wasn't for me bringing in the 10 tribes to you. You owe me." But God takes him out of the picture right now. Of course, what are the people, particularly those of the northern 10 tribes, going to think when they hear that Joab is assassinated? Who are they going to think is responsible? Who gave the orders to Joab to do it? They're going to assume that David is responsible. In modern terms, David has a huge PR problem, public relations problem at this time. So what does David do? What should you do when you got a big PR problem? Call a press conference in prime time. Verse 28. And so that's what David did. He called a press conference in prime time, basically. And afterward, when David heard it, he said, you could say this was publicly, "I and my kingdom are guiltless before Yahweh forever from the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. Let it rest on the head of Joab and on all his father's house. Let there not fail from the house of Joab one that hath an issue, or that is a leper, or that leans on a staff, or falls on the sword, or that lacketh bread." About all that David felt that he could do in the face of Joab's overpowering strength at this time, about all David could do was to pronounce a public curse on him. Now, we're not told much, if anything, about Joab's descendants and how that curse panned out, but they obviously faded from the scene and they had no further importance in the national affairs of Israel after Joab's death, which is a long time to go yet. Verse 30. "So Joab and Abishai, his brother, slew Abner, because he had slain their brother Asahel at Gibeon in the battle." In the battle. This tells us that it was, in fact, a conspiracy, because Abishai was evidently complicit in the plot in some manner, the details of which we are not told. And this also explains why David's curse was not only on the house of Joab, but it says on his father's house, which would include descendants of Joab and descendants of Abishai. Verse 31. "And David said to Joab and to all the people that were with him, Rend your clothes and gird you with sackcloth and mourn before Abner. And King David himself followed the bier." These were highly unusual actions, both for David to force Joab to march in front of the funeral procession and for the king to humble himself to follow the casket. I mean, kings simply didn't do that. But this was David's method of conveying to the people Joab's guilt and his own innocence in the murder. Verse 32. "And they buried Abner in Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept." Do you remember some time back, some years ago, in the Clinton presidency when Commerce Secretary Ron Brown was killed in that plane crash over in what we used to call Yugoslavia, where the plane just went smack into the mountain called the St. John the Baptist Mountain? And you remember, I saw the footage on TV of Clinton coming out of a memorial service for Ron Brown, and I don't know if there were others, but he's coming out through this passageway, and up here there's a railing, and there's TV cameras up there pointing down at Clinton, and Bill Clinton is coming out, and he's laughing, and he's grinning, and joking with the people with him, and as soon as he looks up and sees the red light of that camera on him, in mid-stride, he changed his countenance to one of grief, and produced and wiped away a tear.
I saw that.
Did you see that? That was awesome. The man was an incredible actor. Perhaps better than Ronnie Reagan. One of the best acting presidents we've had, right? But I don't think King David was pulling a Bill Clinton here with his tears. His tears were genuine. David was a man of true compassion, not false compassion. And we've seen that demonstrated numerous times already in our studies. As he did at the memorial service for King Saul, David composed and gave a eulogy. Verse 33. "And the king lamented over Abner and said, Died Abner as a fool dieth? Thy hands were not bound, Abner, nor thy feet put into fetters. As a man falleth before wicked men, so fellest thou. And all the people wept again over him. And when all the people came to cause David to eat meat while it was yet day, David sware, saying, So do God to me and more also, if I taste bread or aught else, till the sun be down." We mentioned a few messages back how the men of Jabesh-Gilead fasted for 7 days. And I said that was not 24 hours a day. They fasted until sundown. Now, here's another indicator that that's what that means. They fasted for 7 days. They didn't eat anything until the sun went down. David denied himself while everyone else partook of the food after the funeral. And these actions impressed the people. And they were convinced that David had nothing to do with Abner's assassination. 36, and all the people took notice of it, and it pleased them, as whatsoever the king did pleased all the people. For all the people and all Israel understood that day that it was not of the king to slay Abner the son of Ner. And the king said unto his servants, Know ye not that there is a prince and a great man fallen this day in Israel? If you'll recall from David's eulogy of Saul, and we notice the same thing here in his eulogy of Abner, that David does not lie about the man's character, does he? But he searches for whatever few good things there might be to say about him and about his character. He seeks the good traits in the man, and he extols these. Verse 38, though, reminds me of an article that I've had in my file for many years. It's from the VFW magazine of February 1982, and it's a reprint of the words of Thomas Jefferson eulogizing George Washington. Allow me to quote a few selected paragraphs and notice the similarity between Jefferson's honesty extolling George Washington and David's eulogies of Saul and Abner. And I warn you, some of what Jefferson wrote might seem to us a little humorous today, simply because we'd be rather shocked to imagine such honesty. It says, quote, Jefferson now, I think I knew George Washington intimately and thoroughly, and were I called on to delineate his character, it should be in terms like these. His mind was great and powerful without being of the first order. You get it? His penetration strong, though not so acute as that of Newton, Bacon, or Locke, and as far as he saw, no judgment was ever sounder. It was slow in operation, being little aided by imagination or invention, but sure in conclusion. Hence the common remark of his officers of the advantage he derived from councils of war, where, hearing all suggestions, he selected whatever was best, and certainly no general planned his battles more judiciously. But if deranged, and that means thrown off course during the battle, if deranged during the course of the action, if any member of his plan was dislocated by sudden circumstances, he was slow in readjustments. The consequence was that he often failed in the field, and rarely against an enemy in station, as at Boston and York. He was incapable of fear, meeting personal danger with the calmest unconcern. Perhaps the strongest feature in his character was prudence, never acting until every circumstance, every consideration was maturely weighed, refraining if he saw a doubt, but when once decided, going through with his purpose, whether obstacles opposed. His integrity was most pure, his justice the most inflexible I have ever known. His temper, or he was indeed, in every sense of the words, a wise, a good, and a great man. His temper was naturally irritable and high-toned, but reflection and resolution had obtained a firm and habitual ascendancy over it. What he's saying there is, when he was younger, he used to have a pretty hot temper, but as he grew more mature, he got it under control. If, however, it broke its bonds, he was most tremendous in his wrath. On the whole, his character was, in its mass, perfect, in nothing bad, in few points indifferent, and it may be truly said that never did nature and fortune combine more perfectly to make a man great and to place him in the same constellation with whatever worthies have merited from man an everlasting remembrance. For his was the singular destiny and merit of leading the armies of his country successfully through an arduous war for the establishment of its independence, of conducting its councils through the birth of a government new in its forms and principles until it had settled down into a quiet and orderly train, and of scrupulously obeying the laws through the whole of his career, civil and military, of which the history of the world furnishes no other example. He has often declared to me that he considered our new Constitution as an experiment on the practicability of republican government, and with what dose of liberty man could be trusted for his own good. that he was determined the experiment should have a fair trial and would lose the last drop of his blood in support of it. I do believe that General Washington had a firm confidence in the durability of our government. I felt on his death with my countrymen that, quote, verily a great man hath fallen this day in Israel, end quote. That's interesting. Did Jefferson know that we're the descendants of Israel? Possibly, unless he was just, all he meant was a simple literary allusion, but it's possible there was more there. As we continue now, David is confiding to some of his close courtiers that, verse 39, I am this day weak, though anointed king, and these men, the sons of Zeruiah, be too hard for me. Yahweh shall reward the doer of evil according to his wickedness. This is quite a confession, isn't it? David recognizes that although he's anointed king, he's no match for the overpowering personalities of his nephews. They are too hard, it says. It means cruel, stubborn, stiff-necked. And the word weak there can mean soft, delicate, or tender-hearted, or simply tender, as in a young plant that's only beginning to mature. So it has the meaning of immaturity. And one would think that in David's case here, that weak means immature more than anything else. There's another use of this same Hebrew word in 2 Chronicles, you don't need to turn there, 13 and verse 7, talking about when Solomon died, his son Rehoboam was a young fellow coming to the throne. It says, and there gathered unto him vain men, the children of Belial, and have strengthened themselves against Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, when Rehoboam was young and tender-hearted, same word translated weak, and he could not withstand them. So we would think that David will soon outgrow this when he gets more mature, and he'll do what's right concerning Joab and Abishai. And what is the right thing to do concerning these two men that conspired to kill Abner? Well, first of all, we have to remember that according to God's law, there is this principle of the blood avenger. Now, we haven't spoken much about it. Maybe you've read about it. But the blood avenger has some kind of right to seek vengeance for a slain relative. But in that case, there is the principle of the cities of refuge, where the slayer could go for sanctuary, in the case of manslaughter. He was not to be touched by the blood avenger as long as he was in the city of refuge. Now, in the case of Abner and Asahel and Joab and Abishai, not only had Abner killed Asahel in a war situation, because we read earlier it said he was killed in battle, but in fact, if you remember, Abner tried to persuade Asahel to go, get away from me, son. You're young, you're a rookie, I'm a veteran, I'm going to have to kill you if you keep trying to kill me. But that's what happened. It was self-defense on top of that. And so, Joab did not have the right of blood avenger. And the case had never even gone to court. And add to that the fact that even if he did have the right of blood avenger, where did he kill him? He called him back from the well of Sarah, and he brought him inside the gate of Hebron. Hebron was one of the cities of refuge. It was a pure case of murder, and David knew it. And yet, he felt powerless to do anything about it. He didn't feel powerless when he was out in the wilderness, and Amalek, the Amalekite, brought him news of Saul's death and said, here's the crown and the bracelets, and I helped him commit suicide. David says, execute that guy. He killed the Lord's anointed. He murdered the king. What's the matter here? David is weak. Is it just immaturity? This is pretty interesting. Turn to 1 Kings chapter 2. It certainly appears that this is a character weakness in David. He feared Joab just as Wishi-Ishi had feared Abner. David's great faith in the providence of God to protect him seems to have deserted him at this time. In fact, for another 33 years, as David reigned over Israel, David never had the courage to enforce God's laws on his nephews. It was a death penalty offense. Instead, David, in his deathbed instructions to Solomon, told Solomon to execute him after David died, saying, I couldn't do it, I want you to do it. 1 Kings 2, verse 5. David's deathbed to Solomon. Moreover, thou knowest also what Joab, the son of Zeruiah, did to me, and what he did to the two captains of the hosts of Israel, unto Abner, the son of Ner, and unto Amasa, the son of Jether, whom he slew, and shed the blood of war in peace, and put the blood of war upon his girdle that was about his loins, and in his shoes that were on his feet. Do therefore according to thy wisdom, and let not his hoar or white head go down to the grave in peace. Well, since David is a type of the overcomers, what does this tell us about overcomers? First, we must remember that David was a man like everyone else, and he had his imperfections. Only the greater David can be our model in everything. When David's flaws show through, we cannot point to David's life and justify these weaknesses in ourselves and say, well, David did it, and David was an overcomer, so therefore we can do things like that. No, we only emulate the virtues of David, not his vices, few though they be. That's an individual level. As for corporate types and shadows, this presents an interesting speculation. Just as David and Joab were in the wilderness with the 600 men before Saul's death, when Saul was persecuting them, right? They were in the wilderness. So are also the overcomer company. We are all, as potential overcomers, we're all in the wilderness now, aren't we? Until Jordan, till we cross over through death. And so, do you think that the overcomer company, whoever they be, that there might be Joabs and Abishais among the overcomer company out there with David in the wilderness? And they are potential overcomers. Will the Davids be strong enough in faith in the providence of God to stand up to such strong-willed men? There are even Joabs now, those who fellowship with overcomer candidates, those whose apparent goal is the same as David's. Which goal was what? The goal of seeing the kingdom come and King Jesus reign in his fullness. But the Joabs want to take matters into their own hands, and they want to pursue their own agendas, along with David's, of course. Some affiliated with the overcomers will give vent to personal vendettas, seeking revenge on those they consider to be in the Saul church, just as Abner was in the house of Saul. David was patient in waiting for providence to work through politics to open the way to rulership. David was patient enough to let the kingdom come. Joabs want to make the kingdom come, to force the kingdom to come, sometimes by violence. Joabs retain bitterness and hatred in their hearts, not just for Philistines and Edomites and Amalekites, but for some in the house of Saul as well, who are their brethren. And the Joabs shall be cursed for it. Not to eternal damnation, of course, but to disciplinary corrections through the various means which my father and your father has designed for them in his own perfect counsel. So do you find yourself spiritually flirting with Joabs, or with the Joab type of personality, wanting to take matters into your own hands to bring in the kingdom, wanting to coddle and fine-tune your bitterness and resentment against someone? Do you want to play with that bitterness and resentment? I hope not, because these Joabite tendencies in all of us must be surrendered at the foot of the cross. But some might say, but I don't want to. He hurt me. Or, you don't know what she did to me. I have a right to be angry and bitter. Fellow overcomer candidates, these are our tests. If it didn't hurt, there would be nothing to forgive. And hence, there would be no way to be an overcomer. Let us praise God for his exquisitely designed trials. What you are going through is perfectly designed for you. What I'm going through is perfectly designed for me. And these are the providentially designed means through which we enter into perfection. Let all creation worship the King. Hallelujah.